I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and they're off. This year's Supreme Court decision allowing corporations, unions, and other non-political groups to spend freely on political campaigns has led to an explosion of ads, nearly $100 million worth, about twice as much as during the last midterm elections. And these groups have also found a way to hide their money trail by funneling funds through nonprofits that don't have to disclose their donors. Take the Coalition to Protect Seniors. Now, they recently hit the air with that ad featuring the talking baby blasting health care reform that he says is bad for his grandparents.
Gramps is sad. I don't know what smells worse, my diaper or this new bill.
Coalition to Protect Seniors is responsible for the content of this advertising.
But who is the Coalition to Protect Seniors? Where are they getting their money? We want to spend some time today on the new political ad reality with Mike McIntyre. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He tried to find out who the Coalition to Protect Seniors is, as we'll hear. But first, Mike, give us some background here. Why isn't there more transparency?
Well, Robin, there's two agencies that are sort of at the center of this whole mess. And one of them is the IRS, which has dominion over nonprofit groups. And it's turning out that, 501c3 nonprofits, 501c3 being the portion of the tax code they're named after, is becoming the preferred vehicle for a lot of groups like this because they don't have to disclose who their donors are.
So it might be a for-profit and very profitable corporation that wants to get a message across, but if they do it through a nonprofit, then nobody knows their money trail.
Well, that's right. And there are rules in place that dictate to what extent a nonprofit can engage in political activity. And the rough guideline is they're not supposed to spend more than 50% of their time politicking. And yet some of these groups, obviously, by any reasonable standard, are in violation of that guideline. And yet the IRS really historically has never gotten involved in this, never taken a look at it, and certainly never launched any investigations that we know of that led to any sort of action against these groups. So that's one part of the problem. The second part is that the Federal Elections Commission, separate from the IRS, also requires that if groups are going to spend money on ads like this, they're supposed to file a disclosure report which reveals the donor's identity in cases in which money from a donor is being used to fund a specific ad. And yet, none of the groups, or virtually none of them, do this. So you have two agencies here which, for one reason or another, just have not, taken steps to enforce what few rules are in place. And as a result, we're left, not knowing really who's behind a lot of this stuff.
Take us down the rabbit hole that you plunged into to try to find who was behind the Coalition to Protect Seniors.
This group literally just incorporated at the end of June, and its website went up at about the same time as it was formed. If you go there, you see some what look like cut-and-paste images of, sad-looking old people and a lot of facts and figures about Obamacare, as they call it. But as far as contact information goes, there's almost none. There's no phone number. There's no names of anyone involved with it. There's an address, which if you do a little bit of simple Googling, you soon find out it's to a mailboxes store in Delaware. And there's an email contact where you can, send off an email, which I did and never got a response.
And most people would probably stop there. But you went on and you realized there's no stories about them, no lawsuits against them, no tax filings, no property records. But as you said, nonprofits have to disclose spending. So you go to the FEC filings. What do you find there?
You find how they're spending their money and who they're spending it with in terms of the ads that they are creating. That's the full extent to which they have to disclose anything to the FEC is if they run an ad, they have to show how much it costs and who they're paying to create the ad. Now, this is the form I was talking about earlier where they're also supposed to disclose who the donor is who's funding the ad if, in fact, they received an earmarked donation for it, but that's always left blank on these things. Mm-hmm. So you can look at it and see, at least where they're giving their money to create the ads. And so doing that, I did come across a consulting firm which helped them place their TV ads.
Okay, this is the Fenwick Group. And
right.
So you call that number and someone answers on the other end and says what?
The person answering the phone identified the place as an insurance agency.
Yeah, the person answers and says, hello, K&M Insurance. Okay, so now you've got somebody obviously based at an insurance company. When you ask for the Fenwick Group, they say you have to talk to a guy named Jay. And who is he?
Well, that was my question as well. He's a guy who's involved in the healthcare technology field. He's a marketing director for another healthcare company.
When he's not, as you write, running dance trance.
Yeah, that was kind of an odd twist, which I wasn't expecting. I'm not sure what it means, but he seems to be a a Renaissance man, I guess. He's involved in a few things beyond placing ads for shadowy coalitions. Yeah, he's got some sort of a dance thing on the side, which was neither here nor there. But so I eventually called back again and did reach him. He was very circumspect. He, you know, would not tell me who the members of the coalition are, other than tell me that he himself was not a member of it. And he said he would take my name down and see if anyone in the coalition wanted to talk about it, and no one ever did.
So here you've got this alleged nonprofit coalition to protect seniors putting out this ad. You track them down as far as you can to somebody sitting in an insurance office. The implication is people who might be against a health care reform have formed a nonprofit to funnel money into ads attacking health care reform.
That certainly could be. I mean, this little exercise of mine took me up to the doorstep of what I think is members of the healthcare field. On the other hand, let's say for a second there really is a coalition and you manage to find out who its members are. Let's say there's 10 members. That still doesn't necessarily tell you who's funding these ads, because these groups, in addition to their membership, can accept money from anybody for specific purposes and don't have to disclose it. So just because you know who the membership is, still doesn't guarantee that you're going to know, you know, who their largest benefactor is in terms of money, because it's just so opaque they don't have to disclose it.
Well, how much has this group spent since June?
You know, not a lot compared to some other groups doing this as well, but as of last week, it was around $400,000.
Well, that's not nothing.
No, it's certainly, by most people's standards, what you'd think would be quite a bit. But there are some groups, like the Chamber of Commerce, for one, and a couple of other groups, including labor unions who are doing this on the Democratic side, who have spent millions with just as little disclosure. Except I will say that there are some groups, labor unions in particular, for whom it's really little mystery where their money's coming from. It's coming from union dues. And you can argue whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but there is some level of transparency there because you know where the money is originating. On some of these business-backed groups, you just don't know.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Mike McIntyre, investigative reporter for The New York Times, about how for-profit companies are funneling money into nonprofits because nonprofits don't have to name their donors. GOP strategist Karl Rove set up a nonprofit, Crossroads GPS. It's been buying ads across the country. And this week, two nonpartisan groups asked the IRS to investigate to see if Rove's group is violating its status as a nonprofit. But putting that aside, Mike, you've said the IRS and the Federal Election Commission have been lax in overseeing these nonprofits, for example, when they don't name donors who've contributed to particular ads, which they're supposed to do. But is there anything illegal when nonprofits participate like this?
Not necessarily, as long as they are complying with the requirements of the nonprofit laws, which are, you know, they require you have a tax-exempt purpose. They require certain basic things, like you have a board of directors and that sort of thing. As long as they're meeting these bare minimum standards, the only thing that could potentially get them in trouble with the IRS, at least, would be if it was determined they were spending almost all of their time in political activities, which they're not supposed to do. But the IRS has never shown any kind of inclination to really seriously pursue that.
Well, and it seems as if this is going to be the trend. The watchdog group Public Citizen found that in the 2004 midterms, 98% of outside groups disclosed the names of donors who paid for political ads. This time around, only 32% have done so. Is anyone in Washington taking a closer look at this?
Sure. I mean, there's been some attempts in Congress. There's a bill kicking around called the Disclose Act, which would add some transparency to this process. It passed the House. It has failed to make it to the Senate floor on two occasions, most recently about a week or so ago. So that is in limbo at the moment. The only other place, as I said, that has in its portfolio, you know, the requirement to enforce this stuff is the Federal Elections Commission. But unfortunately, that commission really has been set up to fail over the years. The commission is literally split 3-3 into membership of Democrats and Republicans, and it requires a majority of the commission to do anything serious, and so most things just die on the vine. Just to give you a quick example, Public Citizen filed a complaint against another group that I recently wrote about called Americans for Job Security. A couple years ago, they filed a very detailed 105-page complaint with the FEC, fully annotated, you know, richly investigated. They also filed it with the IRS. They got no response from the IRS at all, never heard back from them. And the FEC staff recommended a full investigation because they decided that there was evidence that potentially something was wrong there. And the FEC commission deadlocked along party lines, and the thing died. The complaint just went away.
Well, tell us a little bit about this story. You wrote, in fact, on September 23rd, and we'll link to it at our website, about Americans for Job Security. They spent $1.6 million on ads pushing a referendum in Alaska to restrict gold and copper mine development. This is at the headwaters of Bristol Bay. Our Alaska listeners are familiar with this. And now the group positioned themselves as grassroots. But it was more like the Wizard of Oz when the curtain was pulled back. There's some guy manipulating everything from behind the curtain. Who is it alleged was behind Americans for Job Security?
That particular group, based on my examination of it, really operates as almost an adjunct of a Republican consulting shop. It literally functions out of an office that is shared by several Republican consulting firms. And all of its manifestations in terms of the targets it picks, who to campaign against, and the money it takes in, and how it's spent, it really resembles, in many ways, just simply a Republican campaign operation.
Well, it reminds us of the Tea Party Express, which is really Republican consultants, one Sal Russo, who put a few grassroots activists out front, but it's really a Republican consultant organization. But Americans for Job Security, is there anything illegal about that? Not ties to a corporation, but potentially direct ties to the Republican Party?
Well, again, it comes down to whether or not one of the agencies that has some purview over this chooses to make a case out of it. And, the FEC could, I suppose, and the complaints have been filed with them about this specific group. They could, I suppose, attempt to show that they are acting improperly in coordinating what they do with a political party, which they're not supposed to do. Or they could show that, they're supposed to be disclosing the donors for some of these ads, and they haven't done that either. But you're left in the same place because, in each one of these cases, even when complaints are filed, nothing ever happens. And so you're back again to this issue of just sort of stagnant regulation. Nothing's being done to enforce it.
So, Mike McIntyre, where do you think this is all heading?
Well, it really looks to me as if the only people benefiting from these ads are the moneyed interests that are behind them, and we don't know who they are. So you can't really make the argument that this is good for free speech or good for the Republic, which some of these groups do claim when you get into it with them. And voters are really left scratching their heads, not knowing essential information that they should know to make an informed decision.
Mike McIntyre, investigative reporter for The New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
And by the way, the Boston Globe is reporting on another facet of this story. The nonprofit American Future Fund, run by Sandy Greiner, who farms corn and soybeans in Iowa and is also running for state senate. The Globe found the American Future Fund spent $650,000 to help Republican Scott Brown get elected here in Massachusetts, largely by taking his opponent's words out of context. At the time, Brown disavowed the group, and Sandy Greiner told the San Francisco Chronicle, "It's fun to sit and dream up stuff that's going to have to make somebody stop what they're doing and figure out how to respond." Well, that was all back before voters knew what hit them. Since then, the American Future Fund has poured $7.5 million into 20 congressional campaigns. They say they plan to spend about $25 million more to win a Republican majority. No way to trace who's giving them money. Take a quick break. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. The search in Mexico for the body of that 30-year-old American believed to have been killed by Mexican pirates on a South Texas border lake is on hold. David Hartley has been missing for a week. His wife, Tiffany, says they were jet skiing back from sightseeing in Mexico when gun-toting pirates shot and killed him on the Mexican side of Falcon Lake in the Rio Grande Valley. She escaped. Last night, the county sheriff in Falcon Lake told KRGV-TV, the local ABC affiliate, that a drug cartel, possibly the Zetas, threatened Mexican investigators and people who live in the area, and those threats are presumed to be a reason the search for David has been called off. But questions are also being asked about Tiffany Hartley's story. Mexican police say they don't have any evidence of a shooting. This morning on the CBS Early Show, she responded.
As for damage on his jet ski, I don't know. My jet ski, I have no evidence. No, I have no bullet holes or anything. We do have a witness that had seen me racing away from the boat, or a boat. I don't know who he saw.
Joining us on our cell phone is KRGV reporter Farah Fazal. Farah, first of all, how dangerous is this lake? How are people in the area reacting to this?
A lot of fishermen, a lot of boaters have loved this lake for many, many, many years. It has an interesting geographical location, Robin. Half of the lake is in Mexico, and half of it is in the U.S., so it's really an international boundary. The people who live around that lake, I can tell you in the last several days I've talked to them, and they are really now at this point extremely scared to live around that lake. I had an exclusive interview with the witness who helped Tiffany Hartley after she says she escaped from those pirates. And he told me that she is actually considering moving away from this community now.
Well, but then it sounds as if the people in the area believe what they're hearing, that this couple out on jet skis was attacked by men in boats, believe that it's possible. But as you know, people are questioning it. They've raised questions of whether or not there were domestic issues or whether or not they might have been in a failed drug deal. What a horrible thing if you've just lost your husband and none of that is true. But what are people in the area saying?
Well, I think there's two schools of thoughts. I think people can certainly understand where she's coming from, that she's under a tremendous amount of stress, extremely grieving, still trying to find the body of her husband. But there's some skepticism about her story. I can tell you, though, people who live here in the Rio Grande Valley in Zapata County have connections and know the long hands of the cartel. This is not just an idea or some sort of, you know, threat, a nameless threat to them. They know it. They see it. In fact, Old Guerrero, where Tiffany Hartley and her husband went sightseeing at that Spanish mission, the Zapata County Sheriff tells me that is Azeta headquarters in that town. They have their drugs there. They have their guns there. That is their territory, and nobody gets close to the cartel territory, not even Mexican state police. And those are not empty threats. We have seen the murders and the home invasions and the burglaries that can be connected back to the cartel, what people around here know as the spillover effect. That has been happening here for a long, long time. And, in fact, a lot of the sheriffs and the law enforcement will tell you that they've been, sounding the alarms about this up to 5 years ago.
Well, Farah, just briefly, where are we on this politically? Governor Rick Perry from Texas has asked the president of Mexico to talk to him. He's said that he thinks this needs to be addressed. We've heard Mexican officials saying they doubted the story, but maybe also afraid of taking on this Zeta cartel. Do you think this is going to escalate?
It's an interesting question and probably an interesting dilemma. The Zapata County Sheriff would tell you that it's a critical moment here. The Mexican state police are afraid of a gun battle with the cartels, yet there is this immense political pressure on the Mexican government to find this man's body. And on this side of the border, as you said, Governor Perry has asked the president of Mexico, Felipe Calderón, to help in this. There have been many voices, both state representatives here, to get some help on this. Is all of that pressure going to help get David Hartley back home? The Zapata County Sheriff will tell you what really needs to happen here is more money needs to come to the border for border security. Stockton Lake is not protected. So this has become sort of a political issue through the very tragic story of this one family.
Farah Fazal reported with KRGV-TV in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. Farah, thanks.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, let's take a second to hear from some of you. Catherine Carr, recently retired from the Air Force, was one of many who wrote after our conversation about the high rate of suicide in the military. She says a lack of understanding pushes troops to be deceitful. She writes, "When I came back from my first tour to Iraq, I was diagnosed with depression. I went on a very low dosage of Zoloft, but when I listed this as one of my medications, I was told that I'd have to get out of the military, as I was taking a mind-altering drug. So I didn't list it. I found out later that there are many others who've done the same thing." In our segment on segregation in schools, we quoted Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, who bemoaned the fact that years after court-ordered integration, Little Rock Central High School in Arkansas, once all white, is now almost entirely black. Well, not true, writes Rebecca Street. She says Central is approximately 45% white, 55% black. My daughter is a sophomore. We are proud of our excellent school record and diversity. Allison Owen wrote after our segment on the Pew Research Religion Literacy Test, which many Americans failed. You can take it at our website. She did and writes, I know all the answers, and here's why. I'm a member of the Mainline Unitarian Church in Devon, Pennsylvania. I've celebrated the Hindu festival Diwali, visited an Islamic center, swayed to the music at an AME church, built a Jewish sukkah, and celebrated Mass with our Episcopalian friends. I've also discussed Nirvana. We consider religious literacy the foundation of tolerance. And finally, Wendy Reed wrote from Pilly's Island, Newfoundland, to ask if we could please say happy birthday to her grandfather, Charlie, who turns 101 tomorrow. Well, why not? My Willard Scott moment. Charlie, happiest of days. We'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now. Officials in Hungary say the heavy metal content of that red wall of sludge is well below danger levels as it enters the waters of the Danube River system. But still, emergency crews are frantically scrambling to stop the flow and reduce the toxicity even more. It's already had disastrous effects on the first river hit. All the fish are reportedly dead in the Markál River. It all began Monday when that reservoir and an aluminum processing plant burst its banks, burying nearby communities in that red-brown 6-foot wall of muck, 4 people killed. BBC science reporter Julian Siddle is monitoring events from London. And Julian, the pictures that we're getting are heartbreaking. We'll link people to the BBC website. But, you know, people, homes, dogs still tethered in their yards, killed. Can you describe what people are telling you?
It seems to have sort of smothered a wide area, about 15 square kilometres, which may not sound like that much, but that's actually about sort of 12 villages here. There have been 4 reported deaths, but I think at least 120 injuries, and most of those injuries are actually burns injuries, because this stuff is quite caustic. It's a strong alkali, something a bit like, say, oven cleaner in the way it burns, at least. You know, imagine getting that on your skin. That's pretty much what's going on there. But, I mean, the authorities are very concerned that it's going to sort of leach into the soil, and then it's going to be a very long process to try and get it out again. But, of course, also what's happening as it heads towards the water system?
Well, 2 things. Do we understand that some officials in Hungary are saying that this area with, as you said, 12 villages may never be usable again?
That has been what they're saying. I believe that a government minister has been down there and said exactly that they'll have to just abandon the area. Mm. It's going to be an extremely costly cleanup operation. Can you imagine it, sieving through 15 square kilometres of soil?
Well, and as you said, it's heading towards the main branch of the Danube. It's already hit some tributaries. But we understand that it's far less caustic. What's being done to try to, first of all, keep it from progressing and to make it less caustic?
In a way, bizarrely, as it enters the water, it's being dissipated in the water, and that is making it less caustic. If you imagine it, it's a bit like something that you would clean the drains with. Mm. So you imagine that going down your drains, down your sewage system. As it reaches more and more water, it gets more and more dilute. And that's sort of what will be happening in the river system. But it's a question of how dilute does it have to be before we consider it not to be dangerous? At the moment, we're getting higher alkalinity readings in the tributaries where it's actually entered the water. And we've also, you know, we've had reports of dead fish as well in at least some of those.
Yeah, because the Danube flows through Croatia, Serbia, Romania, other countries before going into the Black Sea. Well, meanwhile, Hungary's national police have opened a criminal investigation, but we're hearing that this aluminum plant was checked just 2 weeks ago, no problems found. Is there sense that this is going to be a sort of, you know, as in the BP disaster here, a story in which regulations failed?
Yes, yes, there are definite questions over whether, you know, that was thorough enough. I mean, it looks like it was actually a structural failure of the wall of one of these reservoirs. If you think about it in that sort of perspective, you could say, well, would this have happened anywhere else? I mean, for example, you know, in Northern Australia, there are huge aluminium production plants where they have a similar kind of system of leaving, you know, huge vats of this gunk out to dry out in the air, and then of course they bury it over later, which would be the fate of this stuff in perhaps 100 years' time or so.
By the way, how many other are of these kind of sludgy heaps, this, you know, this waste from these factories, you know, are there? Is there a scramble to sort of make sure others are stronger?
Doesn't seem to be a vigorous effort going on yet to check it out, but it is a global problem. I mean, anywhere where you've got these kind of plants which are involved in this first stage of aluminium production, you're going to have these big piles of waste. In the aluminium production industry, it's called red mud. That's actually what they call it. It's not just a slang term. But at the moment, there's no real way of dealing with it other than to put it in a large reservoir and wait for the water to evaporate off, which can take a very long time, and then to dig it out and put it in a big hole and bury it.
BBC science reporter Julian Siddle, monitoring the events in Hungary from London. Julian, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Aluminium. A terrible story, but I love how he says it. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Today marks the beginning of the 10th year of the war in Afghanistan. U.S. military deaths stand at over 1,300. Add to that the over 4,400 fallen U.S. troops from the Iraq War. Losses that can never be replaced, of course. But surviving families do receive death benefits, and many are now learning they may be getting shortchanged. Here's how it works. The VA pays out, on average, $400,000 to beneficiaries, but they don't pay it directly to the family. They pay it to Prudential Insurance, a private company the VA has contracted with for the last 45 years. And instead of sending beneficiaries a payout check, Prudential sends them what looks like a checkbook and tells them they're investing the money for them, implying they can write checks against the account anytime they want, but they can't. This doesn't just happen to military families. Dozens of life insurance companies use these types of accounts for civilian families, but the military funds are tax dollars. And our next guest discovered that Prudential has been making huge profits off them. David Evans is a reporter for Bloomberg Markets Magazine. David, it looks like the bottom line is that instead of giving death benefit money immediately to beneficiaries, Prudential holds onto that money, invests it, and then keeps most of the profit created by interest.
Right, that's the issue. Instead of sending the checks out to the survivors, what they're doing is they're taking the money, putting it into their general fund, sending out a checkbook, and they're earning the difference between what they make in their general fund, which was 4% in the first half of this year, and 0.5%, which is 1/8 of that, is what's credited to the survivors who receive these quote-unquote checkbooks, which are not really checkbooks. They're called draft books because they're not really checking accounts at a bank. And even though it says J.P. Morgan on these drafts, the money is not at J.P. Morgan. There's no FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, insurance, because these are not bank accounts.
Right.
It's buried in the fine print. It was not made clear by Prudential. The point should be made that an individual can write a check for the full amount at any point, but we know that many do not. 28% of these accounts are still open after 2 years. We've learned from the VA that there's more than $660 million right now that's sitting at Prudential that belongs to these survivors. So that's, while the idea of the account was to provide a place for the money to be held short term for folks to decide where they want to put the money, in fact, we know people leave it there for years. They're making a very low interest rate, and to the extent that they're making a low rate, this is a profit center for Prudential.
Well, I really want to underscore this, David. You know, these people get these checkbooks. Some went to use them, you know, to pay for things, and they didn't work because they're not really checks. They're sort of IOUs. So are you saying that a family says, my lump sum that's due is $250,000, I want it now, they can't get it, they will only get these checks? Or are you saying that they get those checks and it sort of throws them off? I mean, can a family...
Well, I'll tell you exactly what's happened. There's a death benefits form that the VA uses, and it gives a choice to check off with two boxes right now, single sum or equal payments over 36 months. And when someone checks off, as 95% of the folks do, that they want a single sum, they think they're getting a check. But in fact, they get a checkbook. Now, 3 weeks ago, the VA said they're going to change this, and they're going to add another box so that folks will either be checking they want the money over 36 months, not many choose that, or they want a single sum, which will mean actually a check, or there'll be a third choice that actually tells them that they're choosing a retained asset account from Prudential. That hasn't kicked in yet, but that's going to give, for the first time, a choice to survivors as to whether they want to get a check or they want to invest their money with Prudential.
You mean, are you telling me that before this change, when someone checked off, I want the lump sum, and they got these checkbooks that aren't checks, they couldn't pick up the phone and say to Prudential, no, no, you misunderstood me, I want $240,000 right now?
We don't know exactly what Prudential would do if someone said that. People are bereaved, and they figure that the VA is looking out for them. And when they get these books, these draft books, they figure, well, this is the way it's supposed to be, and no one has challenged it.
And by the way, what is Prudential saying?
Prudential says that they're providing a flexibility, a great service to survivors, that they rarely get complaints about this, and that we're creating a problem when there isn't a problem.
You talked to the man who invented this tool. It's called the Retained Asset Account. Jerry Goldschull, is that the name, with MetLife?
Jerry Goldschull.
Yep, Jerry Goldschull. Yeah. He's very clear. He invented this in 1984 because, as head of MetLife, he literally said, what are we going to do? We need to retain some of this money. And he created this retained asset account. And you talked to officials from North Carolina, the deputy insurance commissioner, who told you he was sure the monies were insured. As we said, they're not. And another, the deputy associate director for insurance at the VA, he's overseen the insurance program for 25 years. He said of Prudential, hey, they're really good guys. They don't make any money from this. The VA didn't know that Prudential was making all of this money?
Well, I think there certainly were people at the VA who were aware that this was a profit center for the company. The contract developed in 1965 during the Vietnam War for the first time put a private insurance company involved in paying off life insurance benefits for soldiers and veterans. But the amendment that was made in 1999 to change the means of payment from checks to 95% of the folks getting these checkbooks and the money staying at Prudential, according to the terms of the contract, was supposed to be done in writing, but it wasn't. It was a handshake agreement.
Well, there was a lawsuit that was overturned. Currently, there's a huge class action lawsuit led by plaintiffs here in Massachusetts. It's the family of Jeffrey Lucy, a 23-year-old Marine who committed suicide. He suffered from PTSD after serving in Iraq. At his wake, the military officers approached, asked the father to sign a stack of papers, and then much later, they started to realize, wait a second, we're not getting this interest that is going somewhere else. But what's your sense of the legality of this?
Well, we've spoken to experts who say that there is a fiduciary duty that a life insurance company should not be profiting in this way, but it's a matter that's going to be left to the courts. Another issue exists as to whether or not this, when a family asks for a single sum payment, the implication, as was described by an appeals court in Boston, is that this is a check. But the interpretation of Prudential and many other life insurance companies is that they can send a checkbook, and that is satisfactory to meet the contract. And again, that's what's changed in the life insurance business over the last 20 years. There are now more than 120 life insurance companies that have set up a million of these accounts with $28 billion in them. And a lot of folks, because they have checks or drafts that look like checks, don't even realize that what they have is not a bank account.
That's David Evans, a reporter for Bloomberg Markets Magazine. If you want to read more about how Prudential Insurance handles death benefits for military families, we can hook you up to his writing at our website, hereandnow.org. David, thanks.
You're welcome.
Does good penmanship matter in the digital age? The head of a prestigious private school in New York told the Wall Street Journal this week that some parents say to her, "I can't believe you're wasting a minute on this." But as that article points out, there's research showing that the physical act of writing by hand helps children think better. And the same is true for adults. Learning to write new symbols, Chinese characters, or music notes, or even math symbols by hand creates more advanced neural activity. Well, that would not surprise Platt Rogers Spencer, the father of American handwriting, who believed if you wrote beautifully, you had a beautiful soul. Well, we learned about him last year from author Kitty Burns Flory. Her book, Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting, is both a history of handwriting and a passionate argument for learning or relearning good penmanship. She saw her own handwriting degenerate from beautiful to not so much and wondered if good writing was still being taught. I asked if people were telling her that they can't decipher handwriting anymore.
Yes, we're a nation of apologizers for our handwriting, and at some point it occurred to me, why don't we just improve it?
Well, more on that, but what set you off on your journey was an article that you read about how schools are switching to teaching keyboarding skills. Isn't there a sense that that is all they will do?
Yes, but as I actually thought about this, I came to the conclusion that that is not a good way to be going. We still need handwriting.
Why?
I think it's important, really, on two levels. It's important for children in school to be learning good handwriting at the same time that they're learning to read. They certainly need to know how to keyboard, but they also need to know how to slow down what they're doing so that they can focus on the combination of sound and symbol that is what they get when they are writing a word at the same time that they're learning to read it. Those two things become connected in their minds. It's much more easy for them to learn to read if they're also learning to write.
Well, this isn't just your thinking. You heard this from researchers that...
Yes, I did.
Yeah, handwriting combines creative intellectual process with mechanical skill. It is good for children.
So they say. I'm sorry that more research hasn't been done on the subject, but there has certainly been some, and there's also, of course, anecdotal evidence from teachers. So I think it's really important for children in school, but I also think that it's important for adults, and I think that in school, it needs to be reinforced. It's a continuous process of learning to read and write so that by the time children do become adults, they have a handwriting that they can count on when they need it because, as somebody I interviewed said, try to get through the day without writing anything down. It's just not possible.
Well, and as you say, it's increasingly impossible to read what we write down during the day.
If children aren't taught some species of penmanship, they won't, as adults, be able to read anybody else's penmanship either. Hmm. And if you have a letter in the attic from, you know, Great Aunt Martha, you're going to have to take it to the specialist at some place that they employ people who still know how to read these things. It won't be anything that you'd be able to read. And I think that that is an enormous loss.
Skip us through the history of handwriting. I know you have to collapse it a little bit, but what'd you find out?
What really interested me was the history of handwriting in America, which begins with a man called Platt Rogers Spencer, who was born in 1800, and almost from birth, it seems, was a fanatical handwriting aficionado. And by the time he was old enough to teach it, which was when he was 15, he had devised a really beautiful handwriting. In those days, handwriting was taught mostly in business schools and business colleges, and it was designed for mostly young men who were going to go to work in offices. Spencer's form of handwriting, which grew out of the 18th century copperplate, which is the handwriting we see on the Declaration of Independence mm-hmm. and other documents like that. It was an outgrowth of that, but it was extremely fancy and beautiful. He used to walk along Lake Erie near where he lived and look at nature, the arching tree branches and the flowing streams and the leaves and the pebbles all reminded him of letters, and he devised his letters with those things in mind.
Well, and his story is quite something. This man who set the stage for handwriting was one of the 10 children of a poor widow. He practiced his writing on leaves and bark or in the snow. He once walked 20 miles barefoot to borrow a book with only raw turnips to eat along the way. I mean, he's like George Washington of handwriting or an Abe Lincoln of handwriting.
He really is. And then he became a drunk. He started drinking and pledged in 1832 to give it up. He would never taste another drop. And from that time, he not only became an advocate of teetotalism, but of handwriting.
Well, and his legacy includes a 3-foot stone pen at his gravesite. But also, if you're trying to picture the handwriting, potentially the Coca-Cola Company logo?
Yes, the Coca-Cola Company logo is in Spencerian script. It's something we see every day and take for granted. But when you look at it, it's really quite beautiful.
But Spencer's method was too ornate for the increasingly modern world, so he was succeeded by Palmer. Now, many people have a memory of learning the Palmer method. You did in Catholic school as a child. Tell us about Palmer.
Yes, he thought that Spencerian was a bit too fancy and maybe a bit too feminine for the America that he was born into. He was born in 1860. The focus of America was on business, business, business. It was a world where people were trying to make money. It was very, very important to have not only legible handwriting, but fast handwriting. And Palmer went to work in an office when he was quite young, and he noticed that the people in the office who got the most done and who got ahead fastest were those who could write really quickly. He was really inspired by that. And the Palmer method that he devised certainly was the handwriting that was taught in American schools from the late 19th century to well into the 20th.
Can't you still see it sort of ribboning around the walls on schools? It would be over the blackboard, all the cursive letters. And you write about, you know, following along as the nun wrote the letters and declaring in your diary at age 10 that you were going to write round. So you have round
letters.
Yes,
that was a fad at my school.
getting your first pen that you dipped in an inkwell, you know, wonderful tactile memories. They don't really exist anymore.
They don't. You know, I was talking to a young man at a reading where I signed his book, and the ink was wet, and so he was sort of blowing on it to dry it. And I said, "It's too bad we don't have a blotter." And he said, "A what?" And I told him what a blotter was, which is this, you know, porous piece of paper that you could use to sop up the ink on whatever you had just written. There are so many artifacts of that time that are gone. This is not a bad thing. We don't need to be dipping our pens into inkwells, and we don't need to return to cursive, to the Palmer method either.
Well, yes, you sounded to him like you were Phoenician writing on parchment, but what do we need to do in your mind?
I think we all need to have a legible script. It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't even have to be beautiful.
Is it too late for many? I mean, can you get that now if you've lost it?
Well, my book contains before and after examples of my own script. I had very bad handwriting, like everyone does. I work on the computer all the time. I write my books on the computer. I have to tell you that. My handwriting was terrible. And so I became an advocate of italic writing. It's partly printed. It's partly connected. Connect it where you want. Don't connect it where you don't want. You do what feels comfortable. Mm-hmm. But the letter forms are easy to make, and they're quite attractive. And I now write a version of italic script, even if I'm just making a grocery list.
You point out that in Oregon, they are teaching a modified italic, and that you think should be a model.
I do. I think that that's what they should teach from first grade, because it's not something that you have to learn a printed form of and then a cursive form. It's all the same.
We have to say that when you get a note, a handwritten note that you can read, there's a warmth to it that there isn't in an email, in a Twitter, in the mechanical ways of communicating.
Absolutely. It brings the person who wrote it closer to us. It's immediate and personal. It's individualized. It's a wonderful thing to open your mailbox and find a handwritten letter in it. And I think that there are people in this world who have never had that happen to them, and I really think that's a shame.